Hello, world. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. We are also on live tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI FM 99.5 New York. I'm Hank Key in the studio of PRN.FM, and you can listen to the stream and join us on the air with your telephone calls at PRN.FM to ask questions, share opinions, make comments by calling the toll-free number 888-874-4888. For those who do not have internet access or have a limited internet data plan, you can listen over the phone by dialing 712-775-6850 if you have an unlimited minutes plan on your telephone. For more information, go to our website, pcradioshow.org. This week, we had a blockbuster news announcement from Samsung. Samsung has permanently discontinued production of the Galaxy Note 7. Sales of the flagship phone were halted Tuesday because replacements for the original recalled models were still catching fire and exploding. Shortly after it started doing exchanges, the updated models were involved in several serious fires, causing the evacuation of a Southwest Airlines flight and a fire that sent a Kentucky owner to the hospital with smoke inhalation. The Galaxy Note 7's brand name has been tarnished by the fires, explosions, and recalls. According to the Associated Press, Samsung said that, "Taking our customer safety as our highest priority, so we have decided to halt sales and production of the Galaxy Note 7. The exact number of phones on the market is unknown, but it had sold about 2.5 million when the first recall was issued. After very strong reviews for the Note 7, Samsung was expected to sell nearly 20 million of these units. The company's shares fell 8% on Tuesday, wiping out $17 billion of value. The decision to drop the product is to contain the damage to the Note 7 before consumer fear spreads to other Samsung products. Samsung seeks to minimize its impact on the long-term health and reputation of the company. Samsung still has its flagship, the S7 and S7 Edge, that users can turn to. Some users will switch from Android to iOS. Users that want to stick to Android have plenty of other Android flagships to choose from, such as from LG, HTC, Sony, and even Google's recently announced Pixels. Samsung did not disclose which product line would be introduced to take the place of the Note 7. It appears that, for customers, the option now would be to take up Samsung's offer of a refund or replacement of the Note 7 with a Galaxy 7 or Galaxy S7 Edge, which was part of the offer after the CPSC recall. U.S. carriers including Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile announced over the weekend that they would stop the exchange of the smartphones after reports of fires and explosions involving the replacement. Just a little background. Samsung delivered 500,000 of new Note 7 to carriers and stores, which it said were safe. That came after reports in August of the Galaxy Note 7 overheating, burning users, and in some cases, exploding. Samsung issued a global recall of an estimated 2.5 million devices and said that the flaw was due to a malfunction or a manufacturing problem. On September 2nd, it ordered new batteries from another supplier and started shipping replacements to customers just 2 weeks later. But similar problems arose with the replacement units, which began smoking and forced the evacuation of the Southwest Airlines flight. This incident is notable because this was a replacement device that was not supposed to have the same issues as earlier Note 7s. A Minnesota teenager told a local news station her replacement device melted in her hands, leaving the 13-year-old with small burns on her thumb. A couple in Kentucky, meanwhile, came home from work to find their bedroom filled with smoke from the flames of a replaced unit. On Monday, Samsung suspended production of its flagship Galaxy 7 smartphone in replacement devices, adding to the tech giant's worst-ever recall crisis. This is a disaster for the world's largest smartphone maker and suggested that it failed to fix a problem that had already hurt its brand. In regulatory filing, Samsung did not explain whether specific problems had been identified. Major airlines, air regulators, and airport authorities have reiterated bans on passengers using the phone, saying the Note 7 should not be powered up or charged on board. A South Korean government agency said it was monitoring reports of the fires and warned that the recalled Note 7 devices should not be used or charged inside airplanes. Hey, Joe, that was the news on Samsung. What's your take on it?
Hank, you know, a couple of weeks ago, We were all shook up when word of the brand new flagship of the Galaxy line, the Galaxy Note 7, was catching fire, blowing up, doing all sorts of nasty things, and nobody was saying anything about it. And then suddenly, Galaxy on its own began a recall. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, there were about 2 million units out there that had to be recalled, and people were bringing them back. Then they were notified, please don't plug them in, don't use them, just send them back, and we will have a new model for you as soon as possible. Well, Samsung's a big company. They can move very fast. And so they had a replacement model that came out last week. And you know what? It started blowing up, catching fire, and doing all sorts of nasty things. So this time, Galaxy did it a little bit differently. They try to get ahead of it. And working for the first time with the Consumer Product Safety Commission in this country, they said, while the investigation is going on, they want all carriers and all retail partners here and around the globe to stop sales and stop exchanges of the Galaxy Note 7. The device, they said, could overheat and pose serious safety risks. They're saying the following, and I quote them, consumers with an original Galaxy Note 7 or a replacement Galaxy Note 7, power it down and contact the carrier or retail outlet where you purchased. If you bought your Note 7 from Samsung or have questions, you can contact them at 844-365-6197. I'll repeat that, 844-365-6197. But they say you really have to do one of the following. Exchange your current Galaxy Note 7 for the Galaxy S7 or the Galaxy S7 Edge and replacement of any Galaxy Note 7 specific accessories, and you will get a refund of the price differential between those devices. Or you can contact your point of purchase to obtain a full refund what you paid for the Galaxy Note 7. They also went on to say that customers who exchange the Note 7 device will also receive a $25 gift card, an in-store credit, in-store accessory credit or bill credit from selective carrier retail stores. It's important for you to pay attention to this recall. I know a lot of folks don't always do that. And while there was only a few of the 2 million phones distributed, a very few blew up. If you happen to have been on an airplane like the Southwest last week, you really don't want that fire to affect everybody. The refund that you'll get, if you bought your Note 7, you should contact the 844-365-6197 number, and they will expedite your refund. Or you can just go to where you got it or get support from the place you got it. The problem here, Hank, is not that they didn't respond fast. They responded very fast, but they had a new problem with the one they replaced. And the problem seems to me that Samsung on its Galaxy line has a very serious quality assurance problem. Personally, I don't know what you guys are going to do, but I will not buy another Samsung phone for a long time.
Thanks, Joe. After 5 years of litigation, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on Tuesday in a bitter patent dispute between the world's two top smartphone manufacturers over the amount Samsung should pay Apple for copying the iPhone's distinctive look. The justice's ruling is due by the end of June, and it could have a long-term impact for designers and product manufacturers going forward, because the Supreme Court, if it agrees with Samsung, could limit the penalties for swiping a patented design. Samsung paid Apple $548 million last December, fulfilling part of its liability stemming from a 2012 verdict that it infringed on Apple's iPhone patents and copying its looks. But Samsung will argue before the Supreme Court that it should not have had made as much as $399 million of that payoff for infringement of three patent designs on the iPhone: rounded corner front face, its bezel, and the colorful grid of icons that represent programs and applications. It will be the Supreme Court's first case involving design patents in more than 120 years, when the products of issues were carpets and rugs. Apple sued its South Korean rival in 2011, claiming Samsung stole its technology and the iPhone's trademark appearance. Samsung had said it should not have had to fork over all of its profits on phones that infringed the patents, which contributed only marginally to a complex product with thousands of patented features. Apple has said Samsung was properly penalized for ripping off its work. With the many years of fighting behind these fierce rivals, this case has become mostly about money. The infringement has been affirmed. Now it's whether this huge payment should be affirmed. A group of 50 university professors filed a brief supporting Samsung in the case, as did Silicon Valley heavyweight Google, which makes the Android operating system used in Samsung phones. Apple, meanwhile, has been supported in the court papers by those who emphasize the importance of design and consumer buying choices, which included the likes of Calvin Klein. On Tuesday, the companies argued over a provision in the U.S. patent law requiring infringers to pay a design patent owner their total profits on an infringing article of manufacture. Samsung said in court documents that the article of manufacture here was not its entire phone as sold, as the lower court had ruled, and so its damages should be pared back. If the Supreme Court does not rule in its favor, Samsung said an infringer of a patented cup holder design must pay its entire profits on a car. In its court papers, Apple agreed that an article of manufacture was just a mere component of a product, but said that in this case, the evidence shows that it is the entire phone as sold by Samsung. Yahoo is spiraling downwards. At least, that's the way it looks. Yahoo has disabled automatic email forwarding, a feature that lets its user forward a copy of incoming emails from one account to another. The company had faced lots of bad news regarding its email service in past few weeks. Last month, the company admitted a massive 2014 data breach that exposed account details of over 500 million Yahoo users. If this wasn't enough for users to quit the service, another shocking revelation came last week that the company scanned the emails of hundreds of millions of its users at the request of the U.S. intelligence service last year. That's enough for making a loyal Yahoo mail user to switch to another rival alternative, like Google, Gmail, or Microsoft Outlook. Joe, where does Yahoo go from here?
You know, back in September, Hank, Yahoo announced that virtually all of their customers, 500 million accounts, had been hacked. Names, addresses, passwords, things like that were no longer secret. They were now in the hands of the evildoers, the, what did Reagan call it? Nevertheless, whoever did it was evil, and shortly thereafter, we got word that Yahoo was being sold to Verizon. Well, what would you do if you were Yahoo now? People were starting to cancel their accounts. People were beginning to move away from Yahoo. Verizon's purchase was less valuable every day. What would you do, Hank? Well, I know what I would do, and it was not what Yahoo did. What Yahoo did was they attempted to stop the exodus of their customers by doing something really radical. They canceled the automatic mail forwarding, the automatic email forwarding to other accounts. So in the past, you could set up your account. All email that came in would automatically be forwarded to a new or a different account. Well, by canceling that service, Yahoo assured themselves that many people would not quickly cancel their service and get out of there. They had too many contacts who only knew that address. And by doing that, by slowing down the exodus, they helped, or hoped at least, to help stem the flood from the Yahoo, and they also hoped that Verizon wouldn't back out of the deal. I don't know. For me, if I were Verizon, that would make me speed up backing out of the deal, because it meant that after all, when you buy a company, what you're buying is the personnel. And if that's the way they think, I don't want them working for me. Do you, Hank?
Thanks, Joe. Best Buy got slapped with a big fine for selling recalled products. Best Buy had to pay $3.8 million for the fine because they were continuing to sell recall products to consumers. Best Buy told the Consumer Product Safety Commission that they put measures in place to reduce the risk of sales of recall products, but they were still selling them. Typically, when a company recalls a product for one reason or another, it's standard practice for retailers who sell said products to remove it from their shelves and take it out of circulation. However, a little over 2 years ago, it was discovered that Best Buy was not following standard protocol for recalled products, and as it turns out, that's considered illegal by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. In a July 2014 report, the CPSC alleged that Best Buy, Magnolia, Best Buy Private Auction, Cow Boom, and Tech Liquidators, all which are brands owned and operated by Best Buy, continue to sell products that had been recalled up to several years after the fact. This week, it was reported that Best Buy and the CPSC reached a settlement agreement that will see the big box electronics retailer cough up $3.8 million in fines and penalties. The agreement settles charges that the firm knowingly sold and distributed 16 different recalled products during a five-year period from 2010 through 2015. CPSC said in a statement, Best Buy failed to implement adequate procedures to accurately identify, quarantine, and prevent the sales of the recalled products across all of its supply channels. Staff also charged that Best Buy, in some cases, failed to permanently block product codes due to inaccurate information that signaled that the recalled product was not in inventory. At other times, the block codes were reactivated prematurely and in a few cases overwritten. Even after Best Buy told CPSC that they put measures in place to reduce the risk of sales in recalled products, they were still selling recalled products. In all, Best Buy sold about 600 items, which included more than 400 Canon cameras where the rubber grips were said to cause skin rashes. Other items that were recalled but still available for purchase included Kobe televisions that were known to catch fire, GE dishwashers where a heating element was known to fail and catch fire, LG electronics ranges that had faulty burners that wouldn't turn off, and ISI North America twist and sparkle beverage carbonation systems that were known to explode. A spokesperson for Best Buy told the Wall Street Journal, "We regret that any products within the scope of a recall was not removed entirely from our shelves and online channels. While the number of items accidentally sold was small, even one was too many. We have taken steps in cooperation with the CPSC to help prevent these issues from recurring." Best Buy were not the only ones fined. Comcast was fined $2.3 million in an FCC investigation into whether the company was charging its customers for services and equipment they didn't authorize. The practice of so-called negative option billing charges subscribers for items they don't explicitly turn down. The FCC explains that the practice forces customers to spend the time and effort to contact the cable company to dispute the charges and seek a refund. The FCC said that it received numerous complaints from Comcast customers stating that the company was adding charges for services and gear like premium channels, set-top boxes, and DVRs they didn't order. Some customers said they were billed for those items even after they declined them. Others stated they weren't aware of the charges until they received the unordered equipment in the mail or took a look at their monthly statements. As you might expect, the FCC notes those customers were expending significant time and energy to get the charges removed and requested refunds. In addition to the fine, Comcast will also adopt new policies requiring it to get proper authorization from customers before billing for new services or equipment. More specifically, the company will send out clearly labeled order confirmations separate from the bills that explain any new items. Comcast will also allow subscribers to block the addition of anything new to their accounts. The company must also review how it handles billing disputes and refunds in a standardized and expedient fashion and adopt a method that limits adverse actions, such as late fees, collections, and so on, while a charge is being investigated. Comcast says those changes were updates the company had already committed to make, and they are either well underway or will be implemented in the near future. The company says that after 2 years, the FCC found no problematic policy of intentional wrongdoing. Instead, the complaints stem from isolated errors and customer confusion. I have a simple question. The $2.3 million that Comcast was fined, who gets the money, the government or the customers? In another case, a reseller was offering dollars for old tech gear and then stiff thousands with suddenly lower quotes. The U.S. trade watchdog, the FTC, has terminated secondhand electronics reseller, laptop and desktop repair in Sparks, Nevada. The company, operating under such names as CashForPhones.com, CashForLaptops.com, eCycleBest.com, SmartPhoneTraders.com, and SellYourCell.com, offered online quotes for used smartphones and laptops. Once the quote had been calculated, people sent in their hardware for assessment and were given a much lower revised quote, typically between 3 and 10% of the original amount offered. That's a huge difference. They had 3 to 5 days to request that their hardware be returned, but the FTC found that the company seldom answered its phone and was closed on weekends, even though the firm counted Saturday and Sunday in its time limits. This is a classic case of bait and switch updated for the 21st century. The defendants in this case lure customers with false promises of generous payments, then hold customers hostage once they have mailed the devices to the company. Hey, in the meantime, if an offer looks too good to be true, it usually is. Out in Silicon Valley, Google has been hit with a class action lawsuit accusing them of discriminating against old employees. The Northern California District Court has certified the case brought against Google, allowing aggrieved applicants age 40 and over to join together in filing a single suit. By certifying the case, the court allows the plaintiffs to take on Google's legal might as a combined force rather than individually. This increases the likelihood of a favorable settlement or decision from California-based Google. The complaint originally filed in April of 2015 claims that Google discriminates against job candidates over the age of 40 when screening them. The suit accuses Google of violating the U.S. Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Allegations of age discrimination are by no means unique to Google. Older workers in Silicon Valley have long complained about a culture that prioritizes youth over experience when awarding jobs and venture capital funding. A Google spokesman said, "We believe the allegations here are without merit, and we will continue to defend our positions vigorously. We have strong policies against discrimination on any unlawful basis, including age." Plaintiffs allege that Google has engaged in a systematic pattern and practice of discriminating against individuals who are age 40 and older in hiring, compensation, and other employment decisions, with the result that people age 40 and over are excluded from positions for which they are well qualified. One of the plaintiffs claimed to have been interviewed with Google 4 times between 2007 and 2014 for positions, but was turned down each time after in-person interviews, in part because of her age. She noted on one occasion, Google recruiters asked that graduation dates be included on a resume as a way to check her age. The certification itself, however, is far from finding guilt on Google's part. The judge noted in a ruling that with the lowest standard of evidence needed for a class action, the court may consider evidence that may not be admissible at trial. My comment on this is, companies don't practice age discrimination. The interviewers have to be more aware that they don't introduce cultural and age bias in the interview process. All too often, a rejection of an applicant is based on the person fitting into the organization, not on ability, but with the chemistry of existing employees. The FBI secretly arrested a former NSA contractor in August, and according to law enforcement officials, it is investigating whether he stole and disclosed highly classified computer code developed by the agency to hack into networks of foreign governments. The arrest raises the embarrassing prospect that for the second time in 3 years, the contractor was Booz Allen Hamilton. In 2013, Edward Snowden, who was also a Booz Allen contractor, took a vast trove of documents from the agency that were later passed to journalists, exposing surveillance programs in the United States and abroad. The contractor was identified as Harold T. Martin III of Glen Burnie, Maryland, according to the criminal charges in late August. And Mr. Martin, who at the time of his arrest was working as a contractor for the Defense Department after leaving the NSA, and he's been charged with the theft of government property and the unauthorized removal or retention of classified documents. According to court documents, the FBI discovered thousands of pages of documents and dozens of computers and other electronic devices at his home and in his car, and a large amount of it was classified. The digital media contained many terabytes of information, according to the documents. They also discovered classified data that had been posted online, including computer code, and officials said that some of this was produced in 2014. But more than a month later, the authorities cannot say with certainty whether Mr. Martin leaked the information, passed them to a third party, or whether he just simply downloaded them. In a brief statement issued by the lawyers for Mr. Martin, they said, "We have not seen any evidence, but what we know is that Hal Martin loves his family and his country. There is no evidence that he intended to betray his country. The information believed to have been stolen by Mr. Martin appears to be different in nature from Mr. Snowden's theft, which included documents that described the depth and breadth of the NSA surveillance. Mr. Martin is suspected of taking the highly classified computer code developed by the agency to break into computer systems of adversaries like Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. Mr. Martin does not fit any of the usual profiles of an insider threat," said one official, "and investigators thought that he was not politically motivated, not like a Snowden or someone who believes that what we're doing was illegal and wanted to publicize that. It is problematic for Booz Allen, which has built much of its business on providing highly technical services to the NSA and other intelligence agencies. When the company learned of the arrest of one of its employees by the FBI, Booz Allen said in a statement, 'We immediately reached out to the authorities to offer our total cooperation in their investigation, and we fired the employee. We continue to cooperate fully with the government in its investigation in this serious matter.' I got a simple question. Has the government done any review of Booz Allen's practices in hiring people and how they vet the people? This is a security issue. This is the second time in 3 years some strong security procedures for vetting is not being followed." Getting away for the moment from regulations, lawsuits, class action suits, let's talk about something a little different. I want to talk about what might be coming down the pike. I had asked Marty Winston of News Tips what he thinks of speech recognition. A lot has been done about it. There's some products on it. And is it ready for prime time? Hey, Marty, is it ready for prime time?
Hey, everybody. Hank asked me to talk about speech recognition and why I don't think it's ready to be a part of automation for most of us. And one of the reasons is it is not reliable. It is not dependable. I want you to think about this. Anybody have a dog? A dog has a vocabulary of how many words? Sit, stay, fetch, come, treat, attaboy, good boy, all of that stuff. A few dozen words, not that much, and doesn't always get them wrong, doesn't always listen, doesn't always obey. But a dog is a good companion. Now, currently, you have a bigger vocabulary somehow with the less intelligent cloud entities represented by Alexa and Siri and Cortana. Are those things important to what we're doing? Are those things important to anything? Well, they're fun. That's why they're there. And if you want them for fun, God bless you. You know, ask Cortana, do you want to dance? See what happens. Ask Siri, who's Cortana? See what happens. Tell me a joke. They're really dumb. They're good for that. Are they good for productivity? Well, not especially. And for automation, really, it's not the most reliable path you'd want to take. If you want to say, hey, whatever your name is, turn the shower on, I'll be there in a few minutes, set it to 100 degrees. What you haven't said is Fahrenheit or Celsius. Was that preset? Does the thing know you get there? And it's boiling because it set it for 100 Celsius. You haven't said otherwise. humans are not made to deal directly with computers yet. It will come. What if you're saying, hey, what's your name? Unlock the door. I'm expecting somebody at 3 o'clock. Unlock the door for them. I'm going to be at the office. If anybody comes to the door and rings the bell, just unlock it. Is that safe? What do you think? Would you do it? Would you just let a piece of gizmo? Might as well put it on a timer. Why would you let a piece of gizmo let people into your place? Why would you tell something to set your thermostat when you're not there? Remember, if you can tell it that, so can a hacker on the other side of the planet somewhere. Hey, I'm going to be gone for 4 hours. Set the thermostat to 60, and then in 3 hours from now, bring it up to, you know, 70, whatever. What have you done? You've cost yourself money, because in most homes, recovering a temperature takes more energy than maintaining a temperature. Speech interface doesn't know this stuff. It's not smart. It just can recognize a few words and sometimes gets right what you're trying to tell it. What are you trying to tell it, and why are you using a speech interface for it? Oh, yeah, because it's fun. Until it gets it wrong, and then it's not much fun at all. What happens if you tell it to sprinkle the lawn and don't tell it for how long? What happens if you say, hey, look, schedule something for me next Thursday for the dentist? Have you scheduled anything? Does it know? Can it intuit what you mean by that? I asked about dogs. How many of you have kids? Kids old enough to talk? Do they listen to everything you tell them? A kid's got an enormous vocabulary. Even before speech, they have a vocabulary that is surprisingly rich. They can respond to you. Sometimes they can say things. Sometimes the difference between ah and ah is meaningful to them. Listen for that. It's kind of interesting. An Alexa, a Cortana, a Siri, they're not going to get that. They're there to listen to anticipated vocabularies. Yes, they're pretty good at general stuff. If you say Wendell Willkie, just say those words, the chances are pretty good they'll come back with Wendell Willkie because nothing in the language sounds like Wendell Willkie. When's the last time you cared about Wendell Willkie, really? If you say something like, show me a wiki for grapefruit, it might or might not do that. If it does it, fine. If it doesn't do it, you haven't lost anything. But the intersection of speech interfaces and home security, home automation, or anything with a consequence to your home or your life is something I want you to consider more seriously than just, can you dance, can you sing, tell me a joke. It's not just there to play with. It's there to give you a sense of what it could be. But please, please, please don't take it seriously as productive until it gets a lot smarter. I'm Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. And hopefully we can get an update on speech recognition at some future date. We have the following public service announcements. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be meeting on Thursday, October the 13th. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. And the presentation is titled Red Cross Utilities. The meeting is at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414, and a photo ID is required at NYU. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, October the 14th. That's 2 days from now. And the meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and the presentation is Mac OS Sierra. They'll be meeting at the Old Westbury campus of the New York Institute of Technology. It's also known as NYIT or New York Tech, the Anna Rubin Hall or the 300 building. The Brookdale Computer User Group will be having a presentation on ID theft, how to avoid it, Friday, October the 21st, 7 p.m., building MAS room 100 at Brookdale Community College located in Lincroft, New Jersey. The Princeton PC User Group will be meeting October the 25th at 7 p.m. at Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their main meeting on Friday, November the 4th, 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. And finally, the Rockland PC Users Group has a meeting scheduled for on Election Day, Tuesday, November the 8th, 7:15 p.m., and they meet at the Rasa Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall in West Nyack. Google for Work has a new name. It's called G Suite. The move is an effort to streamline the company's productivity apps. Google for Work has a new name for Calendar, Drive, Docs, Gmail, Maps for Work, Search for Work, Sheets, and Slides, all fall under G Suite. A few of those items might jump out at you as being Google Apps for Work. It all falls under Google Cloud and will encompass Chromebooks too. What's the reason for the change? Google said, we are Google Cloud. The company promises G Suite will continue to grow, with built-in collaboration being the name of the game. What is the Consumer Review Fairness Act of 2016? To prohibit the use of certain clauses in form contracts that restrict the ability of a consumer to communicate regarding the goods or services offered in interstate commerce that was the subject of the contract, and for other purposes. Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and the United States, this act may be cited as the Consumer Review Fairness Act of 2016. Number one, prohibit or restrict an individual who is a party to such a contract from engaging in written, oral, or pictorial reviews or other similar performance assessments or analysis of, including by electronic means, the goods, services, or conduct of a person that is also a party to the contract. It prohibits imposing penalties or fees against individuals who engage in such communications, or, number three, transfer or require the individual to transfer intellectual property rights in review or feedback content with exception of a non-exclusive license to use the content in any otherwise lawful communication about such person or the goods or services provided by such person. The bill does not apply to an employer, employee, or independent contractor contract. The personal computer business is set to grow again, or the number of manufacturers have gone down. Fujitsu is now considering selling its PC business to Lenovo. Lenovo may be about to grow its share of the shrinking PC business again. Japanese IT conglomerate Fujitsu is considering selling its PC manufacturing business, and Lenovo may be the buyer. As part of a strategy to focus on core activities in February, Fujitsu spun out its PC business as an independent operating unit. Such spin-outs are usually a prelude to a sale. The Japanese media reported that the company were in talks to sell the PC business to Lenovo. These reports are not based on any official announcements made by Fujitsu, the company said, adding that it's currently considering various possibilities, including what is being reported, but a decision has not yet been made. Once a powerhouse of PC production, Japan has largely retreated from the market over the last decade. Sharp pulled out of the PC manufacturing in 2010 to concentrate on the tablet market. In 2011, NEC put its PC business into a joint venture with Lenovo. Sony sold its VAIO PC business to an investment firm. A person familiar with the Lenovo-Fujitsu discussion told Wall Street Journal that the deal could be structured similar to the one with NEC, which now holds only 5% stake in its joint venture with Lenovo. Lenovo made a name for itself outside China as a PC manufacturer when it bought IBM's PC division for $1.75 billion in 2005, putting it into third place in the global PC market. Today, it's number one. Fujitsu targets a data center market with its servers, networking equipment, batteries, and cooling systems, and also run an IT services and cloud hosting business. But it also has other businesses not directly related to that, including smartphones, semiconductors, and PCs. Like IBM before it, Fujitsu is looking to hang on to more lucrative services and servers businesses, although even this could change. Almost a decade after their PC deal, IBM went on to sell part of its server business to Lenovo, too. There is a new communication standard, Bluetooth 5.0. A new version of Bluetooth wireless spec is giving users faster connectivity among devices over longer distances will be coming early next year. The new version, Bluetooth 5, is a big upgrade over Bluetooth 4.2. In a clear line of sight, the range of Bluetooth 5 could stretch to 400 meters. That's about 1,200 feet. That means users could connect a smartphone to a Bluetooth speaker that may not even be visible. In a typical realistic setting, Bluetooth 5 will offer a range of up to 120 meters, which is four times that of Bluetooth 4.2, and it will be two times faster with data transfers of 2 megabits. Early versions of Bluetooth were used in audio equipment, headsets, and cars. But Bluetooth has evolved. It's now central to the Internet of Things, and it's being used in smart home products, medical devices, drones, robots, smart meters, and wearables. The faster speed, longer range, and error correction features in Bluetooth 5 will make it easier to push firmware to devices. That will be especially helpful for automobiles, smart meters, and medical devices designed to be placed inside the body. Bluetooth 5 will also have one-to-many messaging capabilities. For example, the devices will be able to transmit data from wearable to multiple devices. There are differences between Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. Bluetooth works at 2.4 GHz, while Wi-Fi-based networks work at 2.4, 3.6, and 5 GHz. The latest additions to Bluetooth promises data transfer rates of up to 25 megabits, while Wi-Fi version and Wi-Fi Direct can reach up to 250 megabits of data transfer rate. Maximum range for Bluetooth-based wireless connections is 30 meters, while for Wi-Fi, it can extend well up to 100 meters. In Wi-Fi, range depends on the version of Wi-Fi protocol applied and addition of antennas in the communication system, while no such concern of range or extra antenna are much known in Bluetooth. In Bluetooth, up to 7 devices can be connected to each other, while in Wi-Fi, the maximum connections depend on the Wi-Fi router, which can accommodate 1 to several communicating devices at a time. Communicating 2 devices over Bluetooth is fairly simple, as there's just a simple key matching process. On the other hand, connections concerning Wi-Fi need an expertise in configuration and security passcode matching process. This makes Wi-Fi connection process more complex than Bluetooth. Bluetooth security is limited to key matching, whereas in Wi-Fi, the security standards have been raised with inclusion of new versions. There's WEP, which is Wireless Equivalent Privacy. Wi-Fi Protect Access, which is WPA, are the two most used security accesses used in Wi-Fi, with the former being less secure than the latter. They're able to work at longer distances and loaded with high-quality security protocols, which makes Wi-Fi a more powerful consuming protocol than Bluetooth. Wi-Fi technology is more used in connecting computers to routers or internet gateways. Moreover, a number of electronic gadgets such as cameras, gaming consoles, PDAs, etc., also make use of Wi-Fi to connect to each other or Internet. Bluetooth, on the other hand, is used to connect peripherals to the computer. Computer keyboards, mouse, headsets also be connected to the CPU using Bluetooth protocol. There are new Ethernet standards, and the new Ethernet standards will offer up to 5 gigabits of performance using cables you already own. Consumer Ethernet performance can be stuck at gigabit speeds for nearly 20 years. Apple was the first company to ship gigabit Ethernet in motherboards. Intel's 875P chipset popularized the feature in the PC market by connecting the Ethernet controller to the Northbridge, thereby offering improved performance. 13 years later, gigabit is still the standard for wired Ethernet. But that might be about to change thanks to a new wired networking standard from IEEE 802.3BZ Task Force. There are multiple reasons why we've been stuck on gigabit for as long as we have. 10 gigabit requires more expensive cabling, either fiber optic cable, and in some cases more expensive Cat 6A or Cat 7 cabling for others. It's not as backwards compatible with previous standards. And routers, switches, and networks that can support 10 gigabits are also far more expensive than their gigabit counterparts. But one simple reason gigabit Ethernet stuck around so long, it has taken a long time for the average home network to demand enough bandwidth to saturate it. That's slowly changing. Wireless performance improvements, the increased popularity of meter streaming, and the slow rollout of gigabit fiber across the United States are all signs that in the long run we're going to need a faster standard. The two new IEEE standard, known as 2.5 gigabase T and 5 gigabase T, should satisfy that need. These two standards were specifically created to use 10 gigabyte signaling, but at a rate that would be compatible with existing runs of Cat5e and Cat6 cable out to 100 meters. The 2.5 gigabit standard can run on Cat5e out to 100 meters, while the 5 gigabit standard requires Cat6 cable to run 100 meters. Both should be far easier and cheaper to bring to market than the current 10 gigabit technology. This is off the beaten path. Toyota unveiled the Kuroba Mini, a robot baby intended to make lonely people more happy. The little machine is 4 inches tall and costs about $400. Toyota has created a tiny robot baby that it hopes can make lonely people more happy. The company's Kuroba Mini is meant to help provide a companion. It looks like a baby and could even serve that purpose for people in Japan, where it would be sold and where falling birth rates mean that there are few and fewer children. The little robot is 4 inches tall, speaks like a baby, and will cost about $400 when it goes on sale. It is a small version of the original Kuroba robot, which has a lot more capabilities and was sent off into space in 2013. The company said explicitly that this time the robot has been made purely to help with the emotions of the people who own it. Toyota has been making cars that have a lot of valuable uses. The general manager who looks after the project said, "But this time we're just pushing emotional value." The robot has been developed precisely to be cute and to resemble a baby. He wobbles a bit, and this is meant to emulate a seated baby, which hasn't fully developed the skills to balance itself. This vulnerability is meant to invoke an emotional connection. The little robot includes a camera, microphone, and a Bluetooth connection. It uses that to connect to the smartphone that makes it work, alongside a small subscription fee. The Kuroba Mini joins a growing market for companion robots. Those companions are just one way for companies and authorities to get people more familiar with robots in general, which are likely to become a central part of Japan's economy as birth rates drop and immigration is discouraged, meaning that automated workers might have to take up some of the slack. As such, Toyota sees the Kuroba Mini as a way of working towards more advanced robots. Those will include the same sort of artificial intelligence that Toyota is working on to drive its autonomous cars and might eventually be able to understand human emotions. Hey, I want one. How soon can I get it?
Yes, indeed. I want one. That's one of the items of high tech that is interesting people at Christmas time, and with Black Friday coming up. We'll see. A recent survey was done on emerging tech on what people really want for Christmas. A record high number of consumers plan to buy new emerging technology, and as a gift for themselves, of course. The most popular gifts emerging will be, well, what do you think it is? There's wearable tech. There's smart watches with wearable tech. There's fitness activity trackers, home devices. There's also digital assistant. Well, I was a little surprised. With wearable tech, 27% of consumers plan to buy something for Christmas that is called wearable tech. 17% are looking at fitness devices like the Fitbit. Smart home devices really surprised me. You know, things like thermostats, doorbells, and so on. 24% of the people surveyed plan on buying a smart home device. 10% are buying them for thermostat control, and I was shocked at this one. The Amazon Echo, the Alexa, I thought there would be very high interest in it. No, it's only 6%. I guess, you know what? Not yet. Maybe it's not ready for prime time. And the VR headsets, virtual reality headsets, 10%. And drones, I thought that would be a most interested item, 9% only. Well, I guess with wearable tech, we'll see what some people will be buying. Talking about wearable tech, Google just recently got a patent for implantation of a device and method for treatment of hypertension. In the abstract of their patent, it says, a method and apparatus for treatment of hypertension with electrostimulation of peripheral nerves. Treatment is performed by periodically stimulating nerves such as the median nerve, and the apparatus for stimulation is permanently implanted in the body. The nerve is stimulated by electrical current applied to electrodes that are placed near the target nerve or the muscle innervated by the target nerve. This invention relates to methods and apparatus for controlling hypertension by stimulating one or more peripheral nerves. It also relates to the field of invasive nerve stimulation using implantable nerve stimulator with implantable electrodes. It also relates to controlling nerve stimulation based on psychological or physiological feedbacks. This data could then be sent to a reader device so doctors can analyze blood and other fluids. Google is looking to patent implantable devices that will keep tabs on a person's health. The patent application describes a method which a doctor or a healthcare provider would inject the person with a small chip that would analyze the fluids in the skin. Data could then be sent to a reading device so that doctors can analyze blood and other fluids. Armed with that knowledge, doctors could make determination on a person's blood sugar level and find out how a diabetic level are fluctuating throughout the day. In addition to this, Google says a technology can be used to detect heart rate and even a person's body temperature. Wow, I thought wearable tech with a watch was going to do that. But talking to my colleagues on the show, Dr. Alfred Poor, he says, you know what, with wearable tech, it's not ready for prime time yet. One of the problems is that because it's invasive, it needs FDA approval. And the other is that the readings are not very accurate. The tracking could be anywhere from 5 to 25% off. I mean, you know, if a person was a hypochondriac and decided to, trust the device, and if the reading is off by 25%, he'd be going to the hospital every day. Well, that's not good at all. Finally, we've been telling people that you can make comments by calling us on our toll-free number 888-874-4888. And it occurred to me that with some people, they may have questions that they would want us to answer them, maybe privately on the air. So if you have access to a computer, if you go to pcradioshow.org, you can send an email message to Joe or myself, Hank, at pcradioshow.org. And if you tell us just your first name, phone number, obviously we have your email address, the topic, maybe you want us to call you, because we do have, we said that you can listen to the show. And so for people who don't have the internet, if they want us to answer their question, well, if you can somehow get someone to get that information to us, we'll call you. In other words, we know that we have numbers that people can call, but the numbers are regional and it may not be a toll-free call for you. Like the number that we've been using is 712-775-6850. And if you have unlimited minutes on your telephone plan, which is about 70% of the people, that's fine. You could talk as long as you want. But we still have 15 to 30% of the people, maybe many of them in the rural areas, that don't have the broadband services. So if you can get someone to let us know, we'll call you. And just let us know what the topic is, and we'll selectively try to find one of general interest to all, and we'll be calling you. And let me just say that this is for those who are celebrating Yom Kippur, we wish them a happy fast. In signing off, let me just say that it's been fun. It's been, I miss my partner on the air, but he'll be back next week. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org. And we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on PRN.FM and 9 p.m. on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. On behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, our webmaster, and myself, thank you for listening. And until we meet again, same station, same time next week, happy computing and good night.